Thank you. I'm Ben Armstrong. I'm a program manager on the Hyper-V team. And I'm here to talk to you about converged networking in Windows Server 2012 R2 and getting it working with Hyper-V. Got a lot of stuff to cover today, so I'm going to fly through it. Apologies if I don't give you enough detail on one specific thing or another, but we are tight on time, so I'd ask if there's something that's particularly interesting, you have questions, jot down a note to yourself and come and find me afterwards. I'm going to be down in the hub, and I'm more than happy to chat at great length about the details we're covering today. Before we get going, I always like to know who I'm talking to. Let's do a couple of questions here. How many people here have already deployed a converged network infrastructure in their deployment? Okay, so we've got a couple of people. So for you people, hopefully you're going to come away with some new tips and tricks. How many people here are currently using VMware and they're wanting to know, hey, how does this work with Hyper-V? What should I be aware of if I'm looking at that? So we've got just under half the room. So there's going to be a lot of information. I will warn you, we're going to be going in deep on a lot of stuff that's Hyper-V specific. I'll try and make sure you guys stay along for the ride. So let's get started. So we're going to go through a couple of things. First, I'm going to do a quick overview of what we mean by converged networking. Then I'm going to spend some time talking about all the tips and tricks for doing the best converged networking for your virtualized workloads. And then we're going to step back and talk about, okay, what about the infrastructure for the hosting environment? And if I have time, we'll get to some other topics at the end, but we'll see how we go on that. So what do we mean when we say converged networking? Well, historically, you know, Windows Server 2008, 2008 R2, we had a recommendation that, hey, if you're going to, you know, do private cloud style computing, then you need to have separate networks for separate functions. And where this guidance actually came from was that we saw ourselves that once you get all this stuff running on the network, it has a tendency to step all over each other. You know, back in 2008, one of the not infrequent problems that we would see was that if people didn't set up separate networks, they would have a virtual machine start generating a lot of network traffic, and it would actually generate so much network traffic that you could no longer remotely manage the server to turn the virtual machine off. You know, and you end up in this state where you actually had to go and physically log into the box in order to fix things. And so we would say, okay, you need to have separate interfaces. But the problem is more and more stuff has moved to Ethernet-based networking, this rapidly got out of control. You know, so we had situations where people would have, you know, a network for management, a network for storage, a network for live migration, a network for clustering, a network for virtual machines, and many of these networks would actually be multiple links in order to give bandwidth and redundancy. And it wasn't long before a typical deployment needed seven or more network adapters. It was a real pain to manage, and frankly, it was highly inefficient. You know, it used to really bug me when we were talking through this sort of stuff where I'd sit there and go like, I understand why we're saying have a dedicated network for management. However, genuinely, your management traffic is usually somewhere in the realm of 10 megabit. You know, and the fact that you had a dedicated network adapter just for that seemed crazy. So with converged networking, we use some pretty cool technology to allow you to first take all your physical network adapters in your box and bring them into a single team, which provides you a virtual network adapter. Then we use a virtual switch to turn that team back into multiple virtual network adapters. So I'm going to switch across to my laptop, and I'm going to show you what this actually looks like. Now, one thing I'm going to be very clear, just so that no one's confused, I'm going to show this demo inside a virtual machine just because that's easiest. This is in no way supported, and I've actually had to do some like black magic that I'm not going to tell you about to make it work. Please don't try and do this inside of a virtual machine yourself. This is just for demo purposes. So I'm going to fire this up. So here I have my system I've got configured with two physical network adapters. And let's kick off the script. So the first thing the script does is it creates the team of these network adapters. And you're going to see those two network adapters get disabled. Here's the team. That's one network adapter. Then the script creates a virtual switch on top of that team. And then it's going to go ahead and it's going to create virtual network adapters on top of that. And these serve the function that I was talking about. We have our management, our cluster, our migration network. So this is actually hugely powerful, and it's hugely powerful for a couple of reasons. The first one is I can configure those virtual network adapters individually. So this script has actually set them up on different VLANs. I can also configure very fine-grained, you know, bandwidth management. I can go in and say, my management network only needs to be 50 megabit. Only give it 50 megabit. It also makes sure that now all of those networks are redundant, because they're all sitting on top of a teamed interface. And it actually gives me, as the server administrator, a lot of flexibility. Because having deployed this sort of configuration, if I find that I'm running out of network bandwidth, I can actually go to this box, I can add another network adapter, and join it to the team, and all of a sudden, everything takes advantage of it. I don't have to go through and reconfigure the switch and reconfigure, all these interfaces. It all just magically works. Conversely, and I've had this experience myself, I have a lab back in the States where I'm using converged networking. I've been on the road, and I've had a network adapter go bad in one of my computers. I was able to connect to it remotely, identify which NIC was bad, and just say, yank that out of the team, please, and disable it. And the box kept on running all the way through. I stopped seeing drop packets from a bad network adapter, and I didn't have to do any reconfiguration. So it actually gives you a lot of flexibility and a lot of control over what you can and can't do with your environment. So let's throw that away and jump back over here. So this is what we mean when we say a converged network. And this is kind of our benchmark deployment. That said, there are some variations on this that we talk about. The first one is a converged network with RDMA. Now, for reasons that I will discuss as we go through this presentation, RDMA does not play well with teaming. And we believe RDMA has a lot to offer for storage and for live migration. So if you're going to be looking at RDMA, what you can do is you can say, okay, I'm going to team my non-RDMA-enabled adapters, and I'm going to use them for things like my management interface, my clustering interface, and for my virtual machines. But then I'm going to have separate RDMA adapters for my SMB traffic and for my live migration traffic. The next one is if you're going to bring in SROV, and that is a terrible color. I apologize for that. It actually says SROV-enabled NIC. It also doesn't work with teaming, and I'll talk about that in detail as we go through. But this is the sort of deployment we look at and think about for converged networking. Now, what does this actually look like in the real world, and what are the gotchas? So before I go any further, another round of questions. I'm curious. How many people here are running their network infrastructure primarily on gigabit? So we've got about just under half the room. How many people are primarily 10 gigabit? Okay, how many people would say, we're 50-50? We've got some 10G, we've got some 1G. Okay, I have to ask, is anyone 40G? Does anyone have... Everyone, find out who that guy works for and figure out where he gets the budget. We have one person who's 40G. So setting up converged networking is actually quite simple. The challenge is getting the performance out of it that you want. So, if you have low networking demand, fantastic. Like, you're done. You should probably be at another session. But if you have high networking demand, you're actually going to find that you're going to hit some interesting limits very quickly. And the next section of this presentation is going to be stepping through a lot of what you can do to get the most out of your hardware. Now, to explain a bit of what's going on behind the scenes, I'm actually going to switch across to my laptop and draw some ugly pictures. So we'll see how this works. So if you think about networking on a single server, so I have, I don't want to be doing that, just a second. I have my single server, and it has a physical network adapter down here. And in this server, I have, let's say, a bunch of quad-core processors. Now, by default, in Intel architecture and in most operating systems, if I have a virtual machine or a process up here that's trying to do networking, any of the work of, taking the data, putting it in a packet, getting it all formatted and sending it down to the network adapter is actually all going to happen here. It's going to happen in the first logical processor. The first logical processor is the one that owns, the primary interaction with the hardware. So these guys are all going to be going through here, down to here. Now, the interesting thing is, actually, let's see if we can have some people take a guess. Does anyone want to take a guess about what speed a modern processor can just handle doing the network stack by itself? Anyone want to take a guess? He says 10 gig. Do I have any advances on 10 gig? Nope. The answer is about 3.5 gig. About 3 to 4 gig is what a single core can push by itself. And now this is interesting because for a lot of us who have 1 gig networks, we haven't noticed a problem yet. But as soon as you start doing converged networking, if you're in 1 gig, you're going to trip over that 3 to 4 gig line. As soon as you get 10 gig networking, and you're definitely tripping over that line. And if you don't do anything, you're actually going to only get about 3 to 4 gig. And the challenge then becomes, how do we get all the bandwidth out of this system? And there are basically two techniques that we look at. The first technique is, what can we do to bring more processing power in to solve the problem, to handle the load? The second technique is we look at, what can we do to reduce the amount of processing that happens? And you're going to need to use a combination of the both of these to get the most out of your infrastructure. Now, as a side note, the one thing that I hope everyone takes away from this is don't just put a network infrastructure together and think it's good because everything seems to be working. Take the time to test it, to profile it, and to understand that you're actually getting the performance that you paid for. I know that even in my own house, where I'm just running gigabit networking, when I first set it up and just, life's good, look, everything, I can copy files around, and I got some bandwidth test tools, and I ran them point to point, and I was like, I'm only getting 300 megabit on a gigabit network. What's happening here? And it took me a little bit of going, poking, changing settings, looking at different drivers, so on. And these days, I get really angry if I see under 800 megabit. I get about 850, 900 megabit out of my home network. But most people, I find, who haven't profiled their networks are probably only getting about a third of what they could get out of their networks. So take the time to measure it, to look at the sort of bandwidth that you're getting. So back to presentation mode. Put down pen, find pointer. So first thing, obviously, is teaming. So I've talked about this. This is functionality that we included in Windows Server 2012. Now in 2012 R2, we've improved it. Prior to that, you had to use third-party OEM software, which was never officially supported by Microsoft. These days, we say use the inbox teaming. It gives you, a couple of things. It gives you, bandwidth aggregation. This is huge. You can have multiple adapters and you can start utilizing them all for your connections. It also gives you link redundancy. So if you have, a network card go bad or a cable disconnected, you're still protected. So a side note here, not for Hyper-V, but very handy hint for non-Hyper-V servers, is you can also use teaming to get VLAN configuration for free. I've actually done this on some of my servers. I've created a team with one NIC just so I could throw it on a VLAN. This is immensely useful because while a lot of NICs support VLAN configuration, very few of them are scriptable. So I have a lot of server deployment scripts, and I can configure VLANs on physical servers in a scriptable fashion by just saying, you know what, whatever NIC is in the box, throw it in a team and then set this VLAN on the team. So that's a little thing. Don't do that for Hyper-V. If you're using Hyper-V, you want to set VLANs on the virtual switch, not on the team. And in fact, this is a great beginner mistake. When you're setting this up the first time and you're doing the, okay, I'm going to create a team and then I'm going to create a virtual switch and then I'm going to create interfaces on different VLANs, if you configure VLANs on the team, the whole thing falls apart. So you want to create the team and just leave it without VLANs. Do the VLANs on the switch. So what does it work with and what doesn't it work with? We're going to be talking about this a fair bit because we do have a lot of different options here that have different compatibility issues. So for the most part, teaming works with everything. However, the big exceptions are RDMA and SRIOV. And these are the reason why these are exceptions is these are both technologies that work by bypassing a lot of the software that's in the host. And one of the things that they bypass is teaming. So as I said, we'll talk about that more later on. One final point that I'd like to make is when we released Windows Server 2012, we provided a number of options for how you do teaming, how you do the load balancing algorithm. And we had some fairly complicated guidance about there are times when you want to do switch dependent teaming, there's times when you want to do switch independent, there's times when you want this option, that option, so on. We did a lot of work in 2012 R2 so that we're now at the stage where we say, look, for 99% of scenarios, you want to create a team that is, let's see if my pointer works, switch independent, with dynamic load distribution. The scenarios where that isn't the best option are really so far and few between. Just go with those options. They're going to be the best ones for you. So, as I said, NIC teaming's quite easy to set up. I use the PowerShell commandlets in the little script that I run. We have these PowerShell commandlets. We also have UI for configuring this, which is nice and simple, straightforward. You can get to it from Server Manager, or you can just launch it from the command line by running lbfo admin. So next, I'm going to just step through how to do this in VMM. But before I do that, there are two things that I want to be really clear on. When you're looking at converged networking, you really need to decide up front, are you managing your environment with VMM or not? The reason why is because if you set this up without VMM and then try and get VMM to understand what you did, it will almost guaranteed fail. You need to, if you're going to be managing your environment with Virtual Machine Manager at the end of the day, then set it up with Virtual Machine Manager. The second thing that I want to take a moment to chat about is I've had a lot of people come to me and say, Ben, I understand how this all works. Why is it so much more complicated to do with Virtual Machine Manager than to do with the inbox tools? And I'm not going to lie. It is more complicated to do this with Virtual Machine Manager than the inbox tools. The reason for this is a lot of the networking stuff, especially a lot of the converged networking stuff, is very closely tied to the hardware. Now, when you're sitting down on a single box and you're configuring it on a single box using the inbox tools, that's fine. The challenge that VMM tries to solve is to say, okay, how am I going to give you a consistent network deployment across 40 different servers with 40 different, you know, physical network configurations. And the way they do this is they basically have you describe your logical network and what it should look like, so that when you deploy it to a new server, they just have to do the mapping between what they think the logical network should look like and what it actually looks like on that server. So as a personal rule of thumb, if you have to set up converged networking on 2 to 4 servers, you're probably going to find it easier just to use the inbox tools. If you have to set up converged networking on 8+ servers, it's going to be worth the time to sit down, get this all sorted out in SCVMM. So the way this goes in SCVMM, once again, understanding the concept of I'm going to create a logical network definition. So I create a logical network definition. I say I want it to be teamed on the left. We've got the PowerShell on the right. We've got the UI. So then I specify the uplink profile for my logical network. Once again, I'm saying, OK, this is going to be teamed. A nice little trick here is you can see this LBFO load balance algorithm is set to host default. What that does is, as I mentioned, we changed the algorithms between 2012 and 2012R2. If you set it to host default in SCVMM, then it's going to use Hyper-V port on 2012 and dynamic load balancing on 2012R2. So it's going to use the right one for the right platform. So once I've done that, then I can go through. And this, what you actually do is you run this the first sequence of steps to prepare it, but you only run the last command for new hosts as they're coming on. So as you get new hosts, you get to say, hey, that logical network that I defined, do it again. And that's the point of this. So as I said, if you're just doing this for 2 to 4 servers, it's going to seem more complicated. But as you get more and more servers, the investment pays off. So that was talking about NIC teaming in the guest, sorry, in the host. But what about NIC teaming in the guest? Generally speaking, this is not something you want to do. Generally speaking, what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to team your network adapters at the host level, get the redundancy throughout the entire stack, and just give your guest a single NIC. And it's going to be, you know, high bandwidth and highly available and redundant because it's sitting on top of teamed infrastructure. There is one scenario, though, when you are going to want to do this, and that is if you're using SRIOV. As I mentioned in the earlier slide, this bypasses the software in the host environment, so it doesn't take advantage of that. So you might think, okay, if I'm using SRIOV and I want to have link redundancy, then I'll just add 2 NICs and I'll team them inside the guest operating system. Well, that won't actually work by default. So once again, over to Ben's bad drawing, so I can step you through why. So let's imagine this scenario. We've got our VM up here, and I've got 2 physical NICs that are capable of doing SRIOV. So I can essentially connect these directly to the virtual machine. However, they are going to go through a lightweight virtual switch. So we've got our virtual switch for each one, if I can spell. So we've got a connection here, a connection here, a connection here, a connection here. And out here, we've got the physical connection. Great. So this isn't rocket science. If you have a switch and the uplink fails, this guy doesn't notice. You know, so by default, if I put 2 NICs in a VM and I enable teaming on them, it's never going to work because the link between the virtual machine and the virtual switch will never fail. So what we've actually done is we have provided a setting on a virtual machine that says, hey, for this network adapter, if the uplink on the virtual switch fails, then mark the connection on the network adapter as failed as well. So in that case, it would do that. Now, hopefully, you can see that this is not an option that you want to enable by default in most cases. In most cases, you do want that if the uplink on the virtual switch fails, the virtual machine still thinks everything's good. But in the specific scenario where you're doing SROV and you're doing teaming inside the guest, you want to enable this behavior. Thankfully, it's very simple. We have a checkbox in the UI, which you can set on a per network adapter here, so enable NIC teaming, and it's also a single PowerShell command. We have equivalent commands and UI in SCVMM. Most people aren't going to want to do this. I do want to be very clear. There's one scenario. If you're not in that scenario, please leave this setting alone. So, that's teaming. Now, VMQ, RSS, VRSS. Here's some really interesting technology. And the heart of all of these technologies are, if we come back to my bad drawing from earlier, where we've got our VM and our process, the heart of all these technologies is what we want to be able to do is we want to be able to say, hey, rather than everything going through just this core, we want it going through this core and 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 this core. We want to be able to use as much processor as we can to drive network traffic. Now, the way we do this is through taking advantage of capabilities inside of modern network adapters, where these modern network adapters now have the ability to represent multiple queues. And we can map a core to a queue to distribute the workload. So that's the underlying hardware and the concept. So why do we have all these phrases and all these words? Well, the reality is VMQ and RSS are actually just different ways of using the same underlying hardware. With RSS, what we do is we look at the workloads that are running inside Windows, and we identify different TCP/IP flows, and we map them to different queues so that we can spread the workload across the processors. With VMQ, we actually use the same queues, but instead of setting them up for TCP flows, we set them up for Hyper-V ports. And so that as you get multiple virtual machines, we start mapping them to different processors so that we can spread the load. An interesting architectural thing, when I get later in the slide, I get to talking about SROV, it's actually the same queue again. It's the same architecture from a hardware point of view. These days, you get a modern network adapter. It's going to have support for queues on it, and they're either going to be queues that only support VMQ slash RSS, or they're going to be queues that support VMQ, RSS, and SROV. But it's the same queuing technology in the hardware. It's just a question of how you're going to allocate it and how you're going to spread this amongst the workload. So what's VRSS then? Oh, how does this come into play? So let's imagine that you've got, you know, a box with 32 cores in it, a handful of 10 gigabit NICs, which have a bunch of queues on them, and you know, we're using VMQ to distribute the workload across the physical processors. And that VMQ is tying processors, tying different ports to processors to queues. And you then create a really big-ass virtual machine. You know, you create, you know, a 32 virtual processor virtual machine, you give it a bunch of network adapters, and you're like, I'm going to run a really heavy network workload in. Well, guess what? Without VRSS, that guy's going to cap out at about 3.5 gig because the VM is going to try and do all of its network processing on the first logical processor. So VRSS is taking the RSS concept and replicating it inside a virtual machine and saying, okay, we're going to spread this out there. So couple of things to understand. RSS, VMQ tend to work with everything except each other because they're using the same underlying hardware. So with your physical computers, you're going to be basically looking at, okay, is this network adapter primarily used for virtual machines or primarily used for a host workload? And you're going to configure it appropriately. Another thing that I want to be really clear on is, like, and I'll be open and upfront here, we've had a fair amount of pain with hardware issues and driver issues around VMQ and RSS. And, you know, I really encourage, do not just handle this by turning off VMQ and going, yep, problem solved. Because what you've just done is you've just thrown away a huge amount of performance. You know, if you see issues with VMQ, you need to be going to your hardware vendor and saying, hey, where are the firmware updates? Where are the driver updates? There was, it was about 9 to 12 months ago, so a little bit of inside information at Microsoft. We have a frequent process where we review support called data and we go over, you know, top support called generators and, you know, figure out, hey, what are we going to do about this? You know, how are we going to mitigate this? About 9 to 12 months ago now, there was a time we were going over this, and I personally got really angry with the support call guys because we got, like, the latest stats from our product support group, and they had, like, okay, here's where we are at with virtual networking. And by their own breakdown, it was, like, the number two issue was, like, yeah, people are seeing problems with VMQ, and we're recommending that they turn it off. And their number three issue was, yeah, people are seeing performance issues, and we're telling them to turn on VMQ. I'm sitting there looking at this going, okay, you are now part of the problem. So please do not, you know, think that you can solve these problems by just turning it off. It's great for troubleshooting. You know, certainly if you're seeing network connectivity issues, network performance issues, you should absolutely go through and troubleshoot and try turning offloads off and turning these options off and see if you can figure out what it is. But once you've figured out what it is, don't just go like, yay, solve the problem. No, you haven't solved the problem. You're not getting the performance you need. You know, go work with the hardware vendor to get the firmware fixes, the driver fixes. So here's a handy little commandlet that you can use that will actually tell you how many queues your system has. So you can run this, see how many queues you have. Something to know, if your number of virtual machines exceeds your number of queues, it's not the end of the world. It just means that, yeah, we're going to start doubling up. You know, that's fine. It won't be as efficient. You know, you will get your best performance when you have more queues available than virtual machines. But if you have more virtual machines than queues, yeah, it's fine. Another thing to highlight is you'll see here that what I've got is I've got two physical network adapters with 63 queues each, which are then teamed, giving me 126 queues. Now, you will only see that if you do switch-independent teaming. This is one of the reasons why we really recommend switch-independent teaming. And the reason why is if you do switch-dependent, so hardware-based teaming, we don't have control as to which traffic comes in on which NIC. And so we basically have to double up the queues. We have to put a queue on each NIC. So if this was a hardware-based team, you would see that the team would only have 63 queues. Because it's switch independent, we can control where the traffic goes to and get the most value out of those queues. Here are the commands. Here are the commands for enabling and disabling VMQ. Once again, really don't recommend it. You know, you can do it for troubleshooting if you're seeing connectivity issues, but not as a long-term thing. So a couple of other things just digging in. This is kind of a historical oddity of the design of VMQ support in Hyper-V. So You can also enable disable it on a per virtual network adapter basis. In the UI, we just have this checkbox, enable virtual machine queue. It's checked by default. The PowerShell is actually set VM queue weight with a value of 0 to 100. The interpretation of this is 0 is off and anything else is on. It's not actually a weight per se. This is actually something that we're probably going to get rid of at some point in the future. To give some context, when we were first developing this technology, we were getting prototype hardware from Intel where they were giving us NICs which had a sum total of 4 queues. And we were looking at this and going, you know, we're probably going to have to figure out how we're going to deal with the fact that people are going to have a lot more virtual machines than they have queues. We'll have to have some sort of priority thing. Well, as you saw on the previous slide, these days we're seeing NICs with 64, 128, 256 queues. It's really not an issue. The hardware has caught up and exceeded. So it really is just an on and off thing. Here's the similar command in VMM and the UI in VMM. So as I mentioned, there's also virtual RSS. And this is what you need to enable inside the virtual machine to get the network traffic spread out inside of the virtual machine for efficient performance there. So a couple of things to highlight here. The first one should be obvious, but a lot of people miss it. This doesn't do a damn if you only have a single VPVM. This only makes a difference if you actually have multiple virtual processes in your virtual machine. And the reality is you won't see you will see a benefit for a 2 or 3 or 4 virtual process of virtual machine. Where you start seeing the real benefit is if you're running a really big virtual machine, you know, with over 4 virtual processes running a heavy workload. So you can configure this either using PowerShell inside of the virtual machine or by going to the UI. And you can see this is the settings on the virtual network adapter. You can go and enable it. So that's kind of all things RSS VMQ. So these are all the technologies that are out there for spreading the workload across the processors. But what about technologies for just reducing the processor work? Well, we've got a couple of those. So the first one is large send offload, LSO. And what large send offload does is it allows Windows to take a large blob of data and just drop it directly on the NIC, and the NIC in the hardware then does the job of breaking it up into smaller packets. Is it just a simple performance optimization? And works with everything, and it's enabled by default. You're probably using it already. You can run this commandlet, and it'll tell you where it's turned on and what it's doing. But that's large send offload. Now, a lot of people get confused about the difference between large send offload and the next technology, which is jumbo frames. And there is a big difference between them. Because on one hand, both of these technologies are about allowing Windows to send larger packets. Because for a bit of context here, when we look at the CPU usage in the host environment for network traffic, just like generating and calculating the header is a lot of the CPU usage. So when we make the packets larger, we do that less frequently. You know, so for a jumbo packet, usually around 9,000 bytes, 9,014 is the exact number, as opposed to a standard packet, which is 15,000, we get a 6x reduction in the number of times we have to calculate and generate a header and so on. And it has a significant saving on CPU. Now, the big difference between jumbo frames and LSO is with LSO, we send down the data, the NIC does the work of breaking it up, and it sends out, you know, standard-sized packets. With jumbo frames, we send down a large amount of data, and it goes on the wire like that. And it's a lot more efficient end-to-end. So why isn't jumbo frames enabled by default? Why aren't we using it everywhere? Well, the answer is, unlike LSO, in order for jumbo frames to work, every single component in the end-to-end network path needs to support jumbo frames and be enabled for jumbo frames. So, and yeah, in the same way, because there are multiple ways to do jumbo frames. So what does this mean practically? Well, what it means practically is you can use jumbo frames for network paths that you are 100% in control of. So jumbo frames are great for your storage network. They're great for your live migration network. They are not great for anything that's going out to the internet. Oh, because, you know, first, trust me, first router you hit that you don't own, it's not going to be configured for jumbo frames. And the way it handles that is by just dropping the packet, which is not so good networking-wise. But if you can get jumbo frames enabled for your internal networks, it can have a significant reduction in the amount of processing time that we spend. So how do you go about doing this? So there are a couple of tips and tricks to understand. The first one is this handy little ping command down here. This is the best tool in the world for this. So you want to do jumbo frames from your Hyper-V server to your storage. Just sit on your Hyper-V server and do ping-f-l-9014 to your storage. If that works, you can do jumbo frames. Hooray! Because what that does is it does a ping. The dash f says no packet fragmentation. Either have the whole packet go through or fail. And it says, oh, and I want to do a different size, and I want it to be the jumbo frame size. Now, most people, you're going to do this the first time, it isn't going to work. You can then do some fiddling. What's actually useful is to drop that number down in thousands. You'll be surprised. It's quite common to have a misconfigured switch. You know, so maybe 9,000 works and 9,000 fails and 8,000 works. And you can try and kind of use that to troubleshoot what's going on. There are multiple standards for jumbo frames. The two that we support are 9014 and 4096. So those are the two that you should be able to get working. Now, once you've verified that you have your infrastructure, in order to get this to work for your entire network path, you have to have jumbo frames enabled on all your physical NICs. You need to have jumbo frames enabled on all your physical switches. And you need to have jumbo frames enabled on your virtual NICs. And they all have to be set to the same packet size. So an obvious question that we got asked when we presented this in the States was, well, wait a second, what about your virtual switches? We did some magic with the virtual switches. If they see jumbo frames, they just go, ah, jumbo frames, and make them go through. So you don't have to set anything on the virtual switch. So what does this look like? So unfortunately, for configuring your physical switches, for configuring your physical NICs, it's going to be different for every vendor. So you're going to have to dig into your paperwork and find out how you do that. For the virtual NICs, thankfully, it's straightforward. We have it there on the NIC properties. You can also set it through PowerShell. Now, and I will say, a lot of physical network adapters, you can use the same PowerShell commandlet to set it there. But if that doesn't work, you're going to have to go digging through the documentation. So now, SRIOV. So what is SRIOV? SRIOV is basically a technology where we allow the adapter to communicate, the network adapter to communicate directly with the virtual machine, not using the switch in the parent, not using a VM bus, directly to the virtual machine. Now, this is great for high-performance, low-latency workloads. It's bad if you want to take advantage of any of the networking goodness that we have in the virtual switch. So once you start using SRIOV, you have to start treating networking inside that virtual machine just like you would a physical computer. So one example of this is if I set up, I've already talked about if we use SRIOV, I have to do teaming inside the guest OS. Another example is if I use SRIOV, I actually have to configure RSS inside the virtual machine, not virtual RSS. So I have to set up RSS just like I would on a physical computer, now inside the virtual machine. And in fact, we actually see this quite a common issue. Because if you think about it, what tends to happen is people tend to look at this and go, well, you know, we've got some workloads that need SROV. However, I like all of the converged networking goodness and yada, yada, yada. So what we're going to do is we're going to use converged networking for as many things as we can, and only for the virtual machines that absolutely need that sort of bandwidth and low latency are we going to use SROV. They set up SROV. They don't enable RSS inside the virtual machine, and then they sit there going like, man, SROV sucks. I'm not getting the performance that I wanted out of this at all. Well, you need to go through, set up RSS, get the performance that you want out of it. So just a couple of things to step through. So as I mentioned, SROV, what we're doing is we're taking the same sort of queues that we use for VMQ and RSS, but now we create what's called a virtual function, and we hand it directly through to the virtual machine. If you're using an SROV-enabled NIC, you actually go into Device Manager in the virtual machine, and you'll see, you know, like Broadcom or Intel or, you know, whatever NIC it is there as the device driver. Now, as I mentioned, you'll want to enable RSS, but there's a catch here. If you want to get the most out of RSS, what you actually need to do is to have multiple queues mapped from the physical network adapter to the virtual machine. So how can you do that? Thankfully, through PowerShell. So I'll get to, actually, that's the, let me do that and I'll jump back. So here's how you do it through PowerShell. So we have, you know, our enable SROV checkbox, which once again we have the IOV wait, where it's just like the VMQ wait. You know, zero is off and anything other than zero is on. Something to be aware of, though, in most deployments today, you're going to have enough queues available. If you have more virtual machines configured for SIRV than you have queues, you actually see slightly different behaviors whether you're using Hyper-V or whether you're using SCVMM. So if you're using Hyper-V, we'll actually let you configure your VMs to your heart's content, and we'll start them up and give them SROV queues, and as soon as we run out of queues, we'll just start them up and not give them SROV queues. That's a bit problematic. So what SCVMM does is they actually do the math to be like, hey, wait a second, like, this virtual switch, this server only has 64 queues available. Don't go and set up 70 virtual machines on it. And they'll actually block you at the 65th virtual machine and be like, ah, no. When you turn that on, you're not going to get SROV, so I'm not going to let that happen. The key one here for RSS is this parameter here. So set VM network adapter, IOV wait, something other than zero, and then IOV queue pairs requested. Now, if you just go through the UI and do enable SROV, it's going to set the wait to 100 and the queue pairs requested to 1. If you're going to set up a monster VM and you want to use RSS and get the most performance, then you want to start bumping that number up. And it will assign more queues. It means that you can use RSS, we can spread the workload. So jumping back a page, with SROV, you need to enable it both on the virtual NIC that I was just showing you and also on the switch. So in the UI, we have this nice little checkbox. In PowerShell, we have this command, new VM switch, enable IOV. But there's another command here that's really handy, because what it does is if you try and enable IOV and there's some reason why we couldn't, this command will actually give you a really lengthy, detailed answer on like, hey, what went wrong? You know, and there are a number of combinations out there that will cause IOV to not be enabled, and you can check that. As a best practice, if you're using SROV, always run this command. Make sure that it's really enabled. So once again, similar commands in SCVMM. Here's the UI and the PowerShell for enabling SROV on the switch. And here's the UI and the PowerShell for enabling SROV on the port and on the guest. So, that's kind of the summary of all the things you can do to try and get the most performance for your virtualized workload. So a couple of things to highlight going over this. If you need more throughput, NIC teaming, first thing to go to. SROV, VRSS, guest RSS, VMQ, LSO, jumbo frames. These all help with throughput. However, they don't all help with latency. So if you need better latency, SROV, VMQ, VRSS. Another thing to be aware of is some of these technologies help with outbound traffic, some of them help with inbound traffic, some of them help with both. So for instance, SROV helps with both. VMQ only helps with inbound traffic. NIC teaming only helps with outbound traffic. So keep that in mind, and as I mentioned, one of the key things I want you to take away from this is profile your network. Understand the performance that you're seeing, understand where the bottlenecks are. You may find that on different networks, you have different demands. So, hosting infrastructure. When we get to hosting infrastructure, what we're really talking about is QoS. How do we configure QoS? Because assuming you've got everything set up, you're using converged networking, your biggest challenge is going to be networks standing on top of each other. And in fact, the biggest ones that we see are rogue virtual machines going out and pumping out a lot of traffic. The other one we see is live migration flooding the network. This one can be a real problem in the fact that we've seen times when, like, a server goes bad, someone hasn't got their QoS configured properly, they go, quick, evacuate all the virtual machines off that cluster node. And it starts a massive live migration that uses so much networking that it causes a cluster heartbeat failure. And then the cluster starts falling apart. So you want to make sure that when you're doing converged networking, you have QoS configured. And here's where you can either use software QoS or hardware QoS. Now, the reality of which one you choose is going to depend on the physical environment that you're in. You can only use software QoS, for virtual machines, you can only use software QoS because hardware QoS is not aware that there are multiple devices on there. But for your infrastructure, you can choose to use either one. So, couple of things to understand about QoS. I'm going to go into some details here. One of the big things to understand is we allow you to configure QoS on virtual network adapters and on the virtual switch in one of two modes. You can do it in absolute or relative. Absolute is where you say, like, this NIC needs 100 meg. Relative is where you can say, okay, this NIC has this weight, this NIC has that weight. Absolute is great if you have strong SLAs that you have to apply to. Relative and weighted is great if your priority is, hey, I want to always be able to live migrate a virtual machine and always want to be able to move things around. To be clear, if you have absolute and you try and live migrate a VM and we can't meet that, you know, QoS policy, we will fail the live migration. We'll say, sorry, we can't make this work. Another thing that not everyone thinks through is, if you have one system set up as absolute and one system set up as relative, you can't live migrate between that because you try and live migrate a guy who has an absolute setting to a system that only understands relative. We're going to say, no, this isn't compliant. So this is something that you should really think about ahead of time and go, okay, in my data center, I'm going to use absolute. I'm going to use relative. So I am about to run out of time, so I have to jump through this. So here are some of the commandlets and the UI. Something to be aware of, the UI by default uses absolute. So if you want to use relative, you're going to have to do it with PowerShell. One nice thing at least is that if you do relative weighting, we just disable the UI and say, hey, you're doing things in PowerShell. Please continue to do that. So there are the commandlets for doing it. In Hyper-V, and here's the same commandlets in SCVMM. So I'm going to skip over this slide and talk about live migration, because I'm running out of time, and this is one of the more important things to talk about. So as I mentioned, one of the biggest problems that people have is getting the cost right for live migration. Live migration is vicious on a network. We basically set up a raw TCP connection and do a large memory copy between two boxes. You can't move data much faster than that. So we have a couple of settings for live migration. The first two, TCP and compression, transfer your data over TCP on port 660. So that's fairly easy to apply a QoS policy to. You can go and either cap it, limit it, set a reserve on it. That's fine. The third option we have, though, is SMB. And QoS for that gets a bit tricky. So I'll step you through what you need to do to set that up in just a second. So here's where you configure your live migration type. We've got the UI and the PowerShell. Same experience for SCVMM. I'm going to skip this because I want to get to the SMB one. But SMB is live migration is tricky from a QoS point of view because you actually end up with a whole bunch of things going over the same protocol. So you can end up with your virtual machine storage, your live migration, and provisioning of virtual machines going over the same protocol. Now, when we were developing live migration over SMB, it was actually our nightmare scenario that we imagined that, hey, what we don't want to see is someone does a large set of live migrations and it starves SMB so much that we see virtual machine guest operating systems bug checking from, you know, slow I/O to the disk. And we tried really hard to make that happen in our lab, and we were never able to make it happen. So as far as we know, that shouldn't happen. Like, worst case scenario, you should see really slow disk performance, but the guest shouldn't crash. But it's still a bit of a challenge. So what we actually did was we added functionality in Windows where you can now go and specify SMB QoS policies, which are specifically for Hyper-V. And we have three QoS policies. We have general SMB, we have live migration, and we have virtual machine. So this is not enabled on Windows by default. So the first thing you need to do is you need to add the feature. You can do this through the add remove wizard, add roles wizard on Server Manager or through PowerShell. And then you can go in and on each category, you can set a cap. And so generally speaking, what we recommend is figure out what's reasonable for your live migration network and cap that so that your storage network is protected. So in summary, the key message here is, you know, for your virtualized workloads, you need to spend a lot of time trying to get, you know, the most performance out of it. For your infrastructure, it's all about protecting the different network flows from each other using QoS. So with that, here are some great resources we have online. I am 2 minutes over time. So sorry for rushing at the end there. I knew I had a lot of content to get through. So I appreciate your time. Hope you found this useful. I'm going to be heading downstairs to the hub, so please feel free to come and find me if you have any questions.